This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
It's the Hot Traffic Fanboys, episode 135.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the frigid, frozen tundra of the hard-traveling studios. Ho-Ho Loon Plaza,
yes.
L-shaped studio,
yes.
Vancouver, British Columbia,
that's
Canada.
Right, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Unlike some people on the social medias, Greg, on the Twitter machine, were spreading rumor and innuendo, casting aspersions on the Great White North and our status of recording here, and I just want to, you know, all those people are full of shit. I want people to know.
Absolutely.
That.
And, you know, not the Great White North. I don't know what that is, but the Great White North.
Yes, when we're
where
here,
we record in person every single week. People don't appreciate the financial and time sacrifices we go through to make this the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
There it is.
They don't appreciate it.
They don't.
So,
they're ungrateful.
And yet here we are braving the elements again. I mean, it's so cold.
One day, Greg, one day we're going to stop doing this podcast and we're going to say, didn't appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the weather here is simultaneously rainy and clear.
Mm-hmm.
The L-shaped studio is designed in such a way that it's difficult to see outside, see exactly what the temperature or the weather is like out there. But luckily, Google will allow me to tell you what the weather is like right now outside the studio here. And I think this is the content that people are here for. And what I'm going to tell you right now, Nick, is that everybody that's been to our studio knows that right now it's 51 degrees and mostly cloudy here in Vancouver.
Yes, people love the weather updates.
They do. And needless to say, Nick, we are here, as I accidentally X out of a very important Wikipedia page that I had pulled up, we are here to bring everyone another edition of the Longbook Hunters.
Yeah, this one was not delayed for 4 months this time, so we're making progress.
Absolutely. And because this one wasn't glacially paced, I was actually able to read it in just a few days.
Woo!
So, Nick, we decided to reach out to one of our good friends who was here in the studio not too long ago, and we decided to bring in none other than the illustrious co-host of Talkin' Pop.
Of God knows what all. How long are we going to be here? This is a Apollo Creed introduction link thing that's about to happen.
Sassy, the Count of Monte Fisto herself,
the Sultan of Swing,
the host of Freak Out Drive-In. The illustrious and longtime hard-traveling fangirl herself, Jennifer Smith, welcome to the studio. I hope you now understand how absolutely real this studio is.
I do, yes. That was quite the introduction. You know, I had to brave the 51-degree weather to get here. It's just amazing that people don't believe that you guys actually travel here.
I don't know who those be, but whoever they are,
I don't know.
They're full of shit.
No. If you can't believe in that, then by God, you better not even believe in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy either, because you're just shattering children's hearts across America when you say things like that. So we are happy to have you nonetheless in the studio, Jenny. You were here not long ago, in fact, for our Walking Dead month. But we're done with Walking Dead month. We've put that in the past,
thank
and we've
God.
Moved on. We've moved on to the Green Lantern side of things. And, Jenny, we've had this assignment for a while, and I think all of us were putting off reading this book until pretty close to the show. That being said, to give a little – by way of giving a little bit of backstory on this this book, this is part of the Earth One series. This is a book called Green Lantern Earth One, and this comes in a line of graphic novel – original graphic novels, standalone graphic novels that have been released going back, I think, 2011 or 12 with Batman Earth One by Geoff Johns and Gary Frank, which Nick and I have reviewed here on the show, both volumes. We also had Superman Earth 1, Titans Earth 1, Wonder Woman Earth 1. And the basic premise of this publishing line is that they are entirely graphic novel format, a series of graphic novels. For instance, there's 2 volumes of Batman, 3 volumes, I think, of Superman. And they aim to address the bookstore audience of comic fans, so people that don't necessarily want to make weekly trips to their comic book store, and they expect more bang for their buck, more story for their buck. So and these are also designed to be alternate takes on traditional superheroes. So, for instance, with Batman Earth 1, we saw a number of kind of subtle changes. We saw a more inexperienced Batman. We saw one character change that Nick and I loved, which was Badass Alfred.
Yes.
From the military. We saw a Batman with no traditional white covering over his eyes, where you could see the fear and terror at times in
and
his eyes.
And a Batman who kind of sucked at his job to begin with.
Yes, absolutely. A Batman who failed, and failed frequently. And it was kind of an original and different take on the character. And I think Nick and I both called it one of the best modern Batman stories. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't had a chance to review Superman Earth 1, but I have read Superman Earth 1, and I thought it was up and down, but mostly good, entertaining, and a different take on the Man of Steel, but not so different that it was unrecognizable. I've not read Teen Titans or Wonder Woman, but Jenny, what is your experience with the Earth 1 line? Had you read any of the Earth 1 books before this one?
The only one that I read was Batman. That's it. And you know, talking about bang for your buck, we'll see when it comes to Green Lantern.
Yes. Yes, we will see indeed. And I do know that you are somewhat versed in Green Lantern. You were a longtime subscriber of Green Lanterns, mm-hmm. Halberd, the Green Lantern Corps. Are you mocking my use of the term subscriber, Nick?
Yes. In the year 2018, I am indeed mocking your use of the term subscriber.
What else would you use to describe someone who had a subscription list at a local
subscription
comic
list? Nobody calls it that. Don't try to pass it off as that.
Are you saying
you fucked up,
her
Greg?
Puller?
We're just gonna move on. We're just gonna.
Should
move
I have
on.
Called her a puller?
A long time reader.
Going to go there.
Reader would have been better.
Are we that low? That
yes,
low in the
we are
ground
left.
With
we are
our
that
class
low.
That we're going to refer to people as pullers.
I'm gonna tell you something right now. I am 100% classless, and I'm just sorry. And that's all there is to it.
That's an inside reference literally only you and I will get.
That's true.
But nonetheless,
but it doesn't keep it from being a good one.
All of us are Green Lantern fans here, I think. Is that fair to say, Jenny?
Yes, it is.
Yes. So this is going to be something a little bit different from what we're used to, because I think all of us are started with Green Lantern or are most familiar with Green Lantern post Geoff Johns, i.e. 2004's Green Lantern Rebirth, which fundamentally reshaped the Green Lantern mythos. And for better or worse, I would argue mostly better, since then, every Green Lantern book has been building on concepts that Geoff Johns laid out. And before that, obviously, Nick, we have both read a lot of the Gerard Jones run. We've read a lot of the early you've read a lot of the 60s and 70s stuff, O'Neill and Adams and stuff. Well, this
Steve
one
Englehart was also at a
Englehart, yeah, yeah. So this is a take, a different take on Green Lantern than any that I've ever seen before. We'll get into that in just a second. But let's talk about the creators here, neither of whom I had heard of before, nope. To be honest with you. I looked them up, and they both have histories with both comics and prose work in sci-fi and fantasy. But they were the co-writer is Corinna Bechko, and then the co-writer and artist is Gabriel Hardman. Or Hardman, if you will. I just wanted to say that. Had either of you heard of either of these people before?
No.
No.
Fair enough. a lot of scintillating intellectual content from three of us.
What do you want me to say? I've never heard of these people. What else is there to say?
Well, none of us have, which is, you know, we probably should have somebody that has heard of these people. But nonetheless, we haven't heard of everybody. And that would apply to these people as being people, indeed, that we haven't heard of. So, Bechko and Hardman. Hardman, artist, writer, Bechko, co-writer. So, basically the formation of Green Lantern has been, with some tweaks here and there, that Hal Jordan is a test pilot for Ferris Air, who finds a dying alien and inherits his ring that gives him the ability to do virtually anything he wants, with a few limitations here and there, and also inducts him into the Green Lantern Corps, which is a galactic force of protectors that watch over the entire universe, in fact, and work for the Guardians, little blue men that tell him what to do. So that's the basic. Did I get that Cliff Notes close enough?
Sure.
This wipes all of that out.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of rebuilds and reimagines Green Lantern as if you were creating the concept now in 2018. And builds it from the ground up. So here, it clearly takes place at an undetermined time in the future, or at least an alternate world that is more advanced than ours, because this is a sci-fi world where we are already out in space and we're mitroids for elements. Because Hal Jordan is a part of Ferris Galactic, which does deep space mining operations, and they get bonuses if they find stuff, basically, that's of value.
Yes?
Flashbacks where we find out that he used to work for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And you threw me off there, Nick.
I couldn't hear you for a moment, so I was making sure you were good to go. Southern Internet, folks. Gotta love it.
Mm. Nonetheless, what was the last thing that you heard from me?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure it was irrelevant anyway. Continue on.
So anyway, Jordan is mining. Jordan with Ferris Galactic, they're mining these asteroids. Meanwhile, he and his partner come across this downed alien ship. In it is the deceased body of someone and a deactivated machine that is a Manhunter, which is someone that would be familiar to any longtime Green Lantern fan. They find a mysterious Green Lantern, if you will, and a green ring, and it leads to a calamity of sorts in space where Jordan's friend ends up getting destroyed by the ring. Jordan is floating out in space. His ship has been destroyed. The ring somehow keeps him alive long enough for him to be essentially shunned by his home space shuttle, Jenny, where he floats by and he says, "Hey, let me back in." And they say, "Nope, can't do it. Too risky. You're radiating, which could affect the rest of us." And Jordan just says, "Ah, you're right." and floats on and waits there to die, essentially. And then a Manhunter attacks, and it kind of sets up the entire universe. So let's get started right with this opening, the opening of this book, where, you know, they're kind of drop us in. There's unspoken backstory where Hal was with NASA and all this stuff. We don't really know what that means at the time. What did you guys make this, the opening of this one? Because I got to say, it felt a little cold, for lack of a better term, to open this book. I was kind of confused. I was trying to get a read on what was going on. What did you make of it, Jenny?
Yeah, same. Really, it lasted a while, but this first little bit, like, you know, between him and his co-worker Volkoff, I'm like, they were drawn very similarly, and so
Yes. You
could barely tell who was who. They had their names on their helmets or whatever, but it wasn't always in the frame, so you couldn't really tell who was talking sometimes. It just, the whole thing was just off.
White, both bearded. It was difficult to tell them apart. I agree, and it felt very cold and distant and removed. And the other thing that it did is it did not distinguish Hal as a character in this opening, where we didn't really have a reason to bite into him. Is that something you would agree with, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, like, this opening, before you ever get into the really, you know, the sci-fi concepts of it, before you get to any kind of alien races or Green Lantern or any of that, you've got this kind of prolonged opening that not really a whole lot is happening. And so, for this opening to be effective, you have to hook on to Hal as a character. And they don't really give you any reason to do so.
He's kind of a quiet loner here.
A quiet, generic loner. Like, I'm not as big a fan of the game as you are, but, like, it reminded me a little bit of Red Dead Redemption, where occasionally John Marston gets called out for being just, you know, oh, look at you, the stereotypical mysterious loner. Like, there's nothing to him. You know, it adds nothing, in my opinion.
Yeah, in particular, I think one of the things that Hal Jordan is most identified with in virtually any form is he is a kind of a maverick character, for, you know, lack of a better term. He is the stereotypical, you know, pilot. He's cocky, he's arrogant, he's a bit of a womanizer. He's confident to the point of arrogance. We get none of that here. This is a Hal Jordan who feels, like you said, Nick, very generic, very un-Hal Jordan. There's a group of Green Lantern fans. There's a subset of Green Lantern fans who have criticized Hal Jordan as being a boring character, which I've always disagreed with. But there's no question in my mind that in this iteration, at least for the vast majority of this book, he is a boring character because we don't have any backstory for him. And like you said, he's so quiet and he's so distant and he's so
timid.
Yes, timid. The exact opposite of what we think of Hal Jordan.
Not arrogant, not funny. There's no quips. There's no one-liners. You know, it's just off. Just not Hal.
Right, exactly. I understand rebuilding this mythos from the ground up and doing a new twist on it, but this is the one area that I don't really know that it ever gets addressed over the course of the book. The characterization of Hal is different, but it's so different that I think it strips away a lot of what makes him Hal Jordan. In other words, if you were to introduce John Stewart or Kyle Rayner or even Guy Gardner in this book, how would they read differently from Hal as he's presented here? I don't know, because, you know, Hal himself is missing a lot of what, like you said, Jenny, what defines him. And, it's interesting to see as that progresses. That's especially the fact that as we find out more about the Green Lantern situation here, Hal ends up stranded in space. He destroys the Manhunter and he ends up – I'm not going to spoil the plot of this entire book, by the way. But he's taken in by Kilowog, and really that forms the crux, I would argue, of this – at least the middle portion of this book is Hal and Kilowog. That's where Hal finds out about what the Green Lantern is, what the Green Lantern Corps is, or was, I should say, because Kilowog sets up the status quo of this universe. There was a Green Lantern Corps. It was mighty. It was controlled by the Guardians. And at some point, according to Kilowog, the Guardians, or at least at some point, the Manhunters rose up, destroyed the Green Lanterns, and only the rings remained. And there's only a few left in the cosmos. Kilowog himself has never actually been a Green Lantern per se. He got his ring passed down to him from prior Green Lanterns of his Earth and was told the stories, the mythos of how the Green Lantern Corps was this thing and this, the legends of the Corps, tales of the Green Lantern Corps, if you will. And so Kilowog sort of explains to Hal, which is our kind of proxy here, his place in the universe, what the ring can do, why it only works when you charge it. And it also establishes some more of the fundamental changes to the Green Lantern mythos that are made in this book. For instance, right out of the gate, there is no oath. You charge your ring simply by touching it to the lantern, and it will give it a brief temporary charge at relatively low power. But no spoken oath, any lantern can charge off of anybody's battery. But the, again, the battery is limited in what it can do and how long it can charge because the Sentry, or so we think, has been destroyed. So Kilowog and Hal kind of talk about the Manhunters and how they've taken everything over. And from there, Hal has to go on a journey along with Kilowog trying to find the Lost Lands, so to speak, which is another concept that Geoff Johns fans will be familiar with. But Hal and Kilowog travel the cosmos trying to hunt down other members of the Corps, other people that might have these Green Lantern rings, to try and build up an army to go after Manhunters who have dominated this galaxy that they're in. The Manhunters have unquestioned authority. They invade home worlds and take them over and install order, which for them is just making the creatures on that planet be slaves and toil away in mines and whatnot. So what did you guys think about these changes to the Green Lantern concept, the way that they're presented here?
But the batteries, you know, that's okay. You know, let's be honest. If you were writing Green Lantern, if you were creating Green Lantern in 2018, the Oath is probably not something that you would try to work in because a lot of people would think it was cheesy or whatever. I love it because it's always been something that's been there from the get-go, but I can understand how somebody approaching the material for the first time may not want it. But it speaks to the Corps as a whole. I feel like the answer to that is kind of incomplete because I get the impression that we aren't really supposed to have wide-reaching answers about the Corps in this one. This very much feels like a lot of setup. Like, yes, it tells a somewhat complete story in terms of you're you know, collecting all these different, you know, ring wielders or ring bearers from across the universe and setting them up for potentially a second volume, but in terms of understanding how the Corps itself is going to work, that seems like it would be mostly explored in a sequel that I consequently am much more interested in reading than I am ever rereading this.
Yes, I completely agree with that. Like, you guys initially got me hooked on Green Lantern through Rebirth, and everything that that book had going for it, dynamics-wise, this book lacks, you know? Yeah, it's going to maybe get me to read a second volume, but it doesn't hook me in the way that that first trade that I read in my first podcast ever was talking about that book with you guys. So it's just, I think that Nick said it right when he said it very much feels like the beginning of a story, but it's not a particularly inviting one for me.
I totally get that because you comparing it to Green Lantern Rebirth is completely fair, I think. That was attempting to sort of, in continuity, restart, recharge, if you will, the Green Lantern concept for a new era. And when you read that book, there's no doubt it instantly makes you invested in this mythos. It makes you want to learn more about the past. And most importantly, it makes you want to journey into the future. You want to consume Green Lantern content when you read it. And I agree, this one doesn't have that same effect.
And I understand it's an Earth one, like it's an alternate. And I'm usually into that sort of thing. Like, I usually like that sort of thing because I don't necessarily have a complete knowledge of Green Lantern. I mean, I have some, but that is normally the thing that is a good place to start, you know, in an alternate reality, because you can follow its own continuity. You don't have to know everything, but at the same time, it's just subpar. It's just not as good.
Right. I totally understand that. I talked about the change to Hal earlier. One thing I didn't mention, I do kind of like changing him to an astronaut. I think that's kind of an interesting, you know, change or update to the character that you can keep him with a similar personality if you chose to. They didn't. I really like Kilowog here. I think Kilowog was my favorite character in this one. I kind of liked seeing a different side or a different take on him where he's not just the gruff veteran Green Lantern that's been there so long. Kilowog is this almost gentle and caring scientist that is kind of an outsider on his own planet. And I kind of liked that. You know, to me, he was the strongest character here, and the strongest part of this book, in fact, were these when they turned the corner and they started looking for the other lanterns, where they went to Aresia's world and they meet a new version of Aresia, different from what we've seen before, and when they encounter, and I'm drawing a blank on this character's name, but the old man that was kind of like their Obi-Wan, if you will.
Yeah. Right.
It was very Star Wars, this portion of the book. What did you guys make of it? That it was probably my favorite portion of the book, other than the end. But I thought the search for lanterns was kind of cool, because it did give me that Star Wars vibe, even if I wasn't getting the Hal Jordan dynamic characterization I might have wanted.
Well, I mean, you're definitely right about Kilowog being the most interesting character in the book. You could make the argument. I mean, the entire plot kind of revolves around Kilowog. I mean, mm-hmm. the stakes are that his planet is being destroyed. Yeah, Hal, you know, kind of makes reference to the fact, well, eventually they might get to Earth, but really, the immediate danger there is Kilowog's planet. Kilowog is the one who takes the action of saving Hal and explaining to him about, you know, kind of in vague terms what the ring is. He himself doesn't have the answers. And then it's Kilowog who sets off and makes the decision to go with Hal in an effort to find the other lanterns to take down the Manhunters. Kilowog in this story is much more interesting than this version of Hal, by far.
Certainly.
Completely agree, yes. Although, I know we're not really there yet, but it's got to come into play when you talk about Kilowog. Like, I'm missing some Ethan Van Sciver art. Like,
yeah,
just goddamn. I can't hardly read a Green Lantern book without it anymore, because this art was just not up to snuff, especially looking at Kilowog. Like, I'm like, okay, I like his character, like, I like his dialogue, and this is great, and I liked his relationship with Hal quite a bit. Like, they had a cute hug toward him that I was like, aw. But he's drawn all kinds of fucked up. It takes it away from me.
I think Nick made that same sound when they hugged.
Yeah, it was cute. Mm-hmm. I liked it. Well, you know, I like the bromance.
From Kilowog's point of view. Then they encounter this other person, Vika Trana, who we later find out has a tie to the Green Lantern Corps as well. His partner was a Green Lantern. And he reveals that the Guardians actually controlled the Manhunters and designed them to destroy the Green Lantern Corps, and as far as he knew, was still controlling them. So it presents the Guardians now as these unseen villains, much to the shock of Hal and Kilowog. Well, later on, Hal himself have an encounter with a sole Guardian who claims to be the last remaining Guardian, and he attempts to coach Hal in how to destroy the Manhunters. And I don't want to there's also a big spoiler with that. That I don't know if we should get into, Nick. What do you think?
Oh, about how the power battery is actually still alive or still around?
No, not that. But the role of the lone guardian in this whole thing, as we find out at the end. Should we say later?
Nah, whatever you want to do.
We'll save that for later. But what did you think of the guardians kind of being taken off the board here? I kind of liked it because I like the.
Well, it added to the mystery, because the whole thing is that none of these people who have these rings really know what's going on. I mean, it's all hearsay. It's all rumor and innuendo and bullshit. Like, it's people just passing down urban legend or I guess in this case, galactic legend, and nobody really seems to have all the answers. I mean, this one guy
– A universe full of Dave Meltzers.
There you go. this one guy, like you said, the older character thinks, that he remembers things a certain way, but, how reliable is he? He's old. He probably has, dementia or something. So, not having the Guardians around, I think just adds to the mystery of it all. Unfortunately, we don't really get all of the answers in this either. Like, we're not really sure what happened to the other Guardians. Were they all, what exactly this Guardian in particular's deal is? So it definitely, like I said earlier, it feels like they were saving a lot of things for a sequel that may or may not happen.
Yeah. I kind of got the feeling he was lying, though, about being the only Guardian.
He very well could have, because I'll go ahead and say that there is – we get a reveal that he is not – what he appears to be, and there is a tease of a long time Geoff Johns created Green Lantern concept that we see at the end of this, as sort of the next evolution of the Guardians' plans to restore order.
Which would be interesting because there's a character in the book that looks a lot like Sinestro, but is never named as Sinestro, and who is seemingly as clueless as anybody else. So, I mean, let's just – we're not be – spoilers, whatever. You're probably not going to read this if you hadn't read it already, and if you have, whatever. They tease at the end the introduction of the Yellow Lantern Corps, which in you know the main continuity we know as the Sinestro Corps, but can't have a Sinestro Corps without a Sinestro, I don't believe.
Yeah, the Soul Guardian even says that you know we screwed up with the Green Lanterns and we screwed up with the Manhunters, but this time we got it right. And it again puts the onus on the Guardians, or in this case the One Guardian, who I don't know if you thought the same thing I did. I'm assuming that this One Guardian is Krona.
Yes, that is my assumption as well. And if it is Krona, then it would only stand to reason that there are other Guardians still out there somewhere, just not in the same physical.
Yeah, it totally looked like he was avoiding a lot of questions that Hal had for him.
Yes, the great Hal asked him a question followed by silence.
Yes. Oh, one thing I did like, I know I've been pretty negative about this so far. One thing I did like was when Hal ended up being a slave.
Yes.
And as his ring drained of battery, it did not translate the alien languages for him anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's a long sequence of him not understanding what anybody's saying. And so you basically just have to go by the art to kind of follow what's happening. And, you know, I thought that was a nice touch.
I agree. That's a great thing. I'm glad you pointed that out. That's a good something to see in this book, because I think a lot of times as comic book readers, we kind of take it for granted and forget about it because it's just kind of part of the lexicon and probably wasn't even thought about in the 60s and 70s when Green Lantern was created. That the only reason, because sometimes you'll be reading comics and think, well, how can everybody understand each other when they're alien cultures and whatnot? Mm-hmm. And the reason is that the ring translates. And the book makes it a point to take this to its logical conclusion of what happens when the ring battery fails. It's out of charge. And you get a lot of cool-looking alien dialects in this slave colony. You also, I think this is the one area of the book that they do succeed in with their lead character, is that in that it establishes that Hal Jordan at his core is a hero, because the fact that his life is on the line, that he is the one that is kind of that's been taken far out of his depth, doesn't know where he is, has physical disadvantages over everyone around him, he is still willing to fight for, save the very people who, I mean, let's face it, in that mind, he's getting attacked, he's getting beaten up, he's getting threatened with death. And he's still willing to save these people who don't give a damn about him, including this one alien woman who betrays him and steals his ring at one point. So
yep.
I thought this was a real strong portion of the book as well. Nick?
Yeah, I would agree. It was interesting. Gave it a little bit of a hook. You know, throughout this book, as we've said before, it struggles whenever it's dealing with Hal exclusively. Because here in this portion, you know, it's not really expanding. It's not really showing you much more about this deeper mystery. It's just kind of showing you Hal, and here he is being a slave. But when you take the ring away and you have these interesting interactions and these things that force you to look at the character of Hal in a little bit of a different fashion, it helps. They need to find – if there winds up being a sequel, they've got to find more ways to put this version of Hal in unique situations and find ways to develop this character, or else this Green Lantern Earth 1 series I don't think is going to be long for the Earth.
Oh, I see what you did there. Oh, very good. Very good. Well, yeah, I guess we've kind of talked about the plot of this. What about the Manhunters as villains? I will say this is another strength of this. I liked this reimagining of the Manhunters, taking them, yes, pretty much the same Manhunters that we've encountered in every other version, but I think making them more analytical, making them honestly more powerful. Because I think maybe you might disagree with me, Nick, and Jenny. I don't know if you've encountered the Manhunters much in your reading, but most of the time when I've encountered the Manhunters, they've kind of felt like jobbers to me. They felt like, you know, not quite like putties, but like maybe like the Sentinels on the X-Men cartoon, where they're pretty easily disposed of unless it's Master Mold. But, you know, one blast will pretty much take him out. So most of the stories that I've read, the Manhunters have not been terribly difficult to fight. Here, the Manhunters are presented as virtually impossible to overcome without the combined, full-powered might of the Corps. And, you know, it does beg the question, I think, of how they were able to defeat the Corps in the first place, but perhaps with a surprise attack or something, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But what did you guys think about the Manhunters here as the central antagonists?
Yeah, they definitely felt menacing to me. Like, Kilowog was clearly afraid of them, you know, and there's a whole force on his planet. Basically, the protection of his planet is just basically against the Manhunters. So they were definitely threatening. Towards the end, when everybody's kind of coming into figuring out what's happening and they get their rings powered, it feels diminished quite a bit. But, you know, I guess they got to be beaten somehow.
Well, I think part of the problem, I agree that with you, Greg, that physically they are a little bit more interesting than the typical Manhunter. The problem with using the Manhunters right off the bat is it doesn't give Hal or the rest of the Corps an interesting villain to bump up against. It gives you a strictly physical threat. There's no dog to be exchanged. There's no exchange of ideas. There is no character, really. It's just this thing. And I think that would have been another opportunity had it been, you know, I don't know, a Hector Hammond or pick a Green Lantern villain. I'm just using Hector Hammond because he looks funny.
Sonar.
Yeah. King Shark, you know, pick one. Any other Green Lantern villain would have at least given Hal someone to converse with. You know what I mean? And that sounds.
But at the same time, with what they're doing with kind of like building.
Right.
You know, this is sort of like a introductory.
I agree, but the problem is there's a black hole at the center of it, and it is boring, bland Earth One Hal Jordan. And True. The more opportunities you give him to develop some sort of personality, the better the book would have been as a result. There's a lot of cool concepts in here that I'm intrigued by, and I actually kind of – the art, for the most part, I kind of like it. But outside of Kilowog, it's hard to get behind any of these characterizations for anyone. It's a tough slog in that context.
Interesting point that you say that, because I actually really liked this take on Arisia.
Arisia. I forgot about her.
As a warrior, as a warrior woman, yep. Instead of kind of the timid Arisia.
No, I'll totally give you that one. I forgot about her because she doesn't pop up until near the end of the book, but I'll give that to you, totally.
But I kind of giggled, though, towards the end when they're like, okay, we're all going to be a group now, and we need a leader. Oh, how about you? Okay, I'll do it. And it was all just like... Yeah. Automatic and
that's something
weird.
We definitely need to address now. The pacing of this book. Mm-hmm. So
oddly slow at times and bizarrely fast at times.
Fast at times, yes. This was a very quick read for me because there's a lot of pages, for lack of a better term. There's a lot of text-free pages that made it easy to read. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you said it. You described it perfectly. There are times when it literally paced, like at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times when things just happen.
Yes.
I can't think of a better way to put it. Like, almost as if, you know, those the good comparison, Nick, the DC animated movies.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that we talk about that 70-minute runtime that has hurt some of the movies because it feels like they have to condense everything down. It almost feels like there was an artificial page count on this. And they had the ideas, but they needed to stretch them out and massage them at times. And instead, they have to rapidly. I thought to your point, Jenny, the scene where Arisia accepts leadership felt very fast to me. Mm-hmm. In fact, the entire transition from when they, spoiler alert, defeat the Manhunters. I know it's hard to believe, but when they defeat the Manhunters, the next like 5 pages feels like 6 months of storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's incredible how much happens in that next 5 pages because you get like they go to all these different planets and they save these planners and free them. They reestablish the Green Lantern Corps. They make Arisia the leader. She accepts. Hal returns to Earth. It's a lot.
Reconnects with the woman who left him for dead.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even slap her in the face with his dick or anything. That's definitely what he should have done.
Well, no, that would have been she would have welcomed that, probably.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, he is Hal Jordan. Yeah. It may be a different, uninteresting version of Hal Jordan, but he's still Hal Jordan.
He's still Hal Jordan. Well, never mind. Now that I think about it, you know, if he had done that, he probably would have given her multiple STDs instantly. So, maybe that is.
I don't know. This is a relatively chaste Hal Jordan. Remember,
there was nothing. There was no sexual tension in the place.
No.
Why I hated it.
I thought he was going to sleep with that alien woman in the slave colony with him.
Yeah, well, she was all tentacly and, like,
sometimes you just got to find out.
That's true.
A little tentacle around the scrotum never hurt anyone.
Mm-hmm. Or elsewhere, you know? We know what this version of Hal's into. Not for us to say, quite frankly.
Or maybe would have
been. Seems very vanilla to me, so that's what I'm saying.
Just straight missionary from
there's
Middle
nothing
East.
Wrong with the missionary. He doesn't want to take his pants off. That. He wants to pull his penis through this little hole here.
through the hole of the underwear.
He would never let Kyle Rayner sit in the corner and jerk off. That's what I'm saying.
No. He'd probably let Kyle Rayner come in and do it for him. He's just that self. All right, Kyle, it's time for you to take your next step. For some reason, I'm a news anchor. Anyway, yeah, so
I can see Dan Quayle, Hal Jordan, as having that voice. Not that inconceivable.
Carol, I've come back to reunite with you, but clearly you're married to another man, so I guess I'll just mourn over here in the corner. Sad Dan Quayle.
Don't mind me. Hal Jordan.
Hey, Superman, what do you think of my green sling that I got my broken arm in?
Hey, man, that run of Green Lantern is pretty good.
It is good. It is really good, actually. But that notwithstanding, yeah, there is no sexual tension in this
Quite
book to
frankly.
Speak of. I was waiting for the tentacle lady to seduce Hal. It didn't happen. Aresia is a warrior woman. She's not interested in Hal. And
the gimmick here. That's how they're going to reinvent it, is that she'll be the dom to his sub. How about that?
Ooh, I can see it.
Now you're talking.
And then I thought maybe Hal was going to get with his boss lady from the space program, but they
see. I thought when he came back to Earth, I didn't understand. Like, you know, we're joking, but were we supposed to have gotten some sort of additional meaning out of that opening scene that they had this deep relationship? Because like when he comes back at the end and goes and talks to her, I'm like, her of all people, why?
Yeah, and
like,
he calls her Amy, which we didn't hear him call her at all at the beginning. We didn't see any of this backstory.
We got a flashback that showed like him talking to Carol Ferris, like this version of Carol Ferris or whatever, and that seemed like it was a close relationship. But this other chick just seemed really, really random and out of nowhere. I didn't get it.
And she left it fucking dead, and she held up a sign that said, "Our thoughts are with you."
Thoughts and prayers.
Thoughts and prayers.
I'm like, what the shit?
To which Hal should have said, to which the real Hal Jordan would say, fuck your thoughts and prayers.
But this Hal just said, okay.
Yeah, you know, you're right, I get it.
What's even better about that scene is she's like, we can't let him in. And the other guy's like, well, can't we just send the other ship out there and he can get on that ship? And she just ignores him and moves on.
She's just like, quiet, you're fired.
He has to die.
That sounds like the cover to a Silver Age comic. Hal Jordan has to die.
Yes.
Oh Lord. So yeah, he comes back. And, like, okay, I might have brought this up too because this is an aspect of the book that I absolutely did not like. Because, and I'll be the first to admit this could be a comprehension problem on my end. Mm-hmm. I did not understand. I didn't pick up what they were dropping down during the course of this in these flashback sequences. I don't understand the point of any. He was with NASA. NASA started working with some corporation, and they did bad things that we're not aware of what they are, and Hal decided to become a space miner.
Yeah. The implication I get – because Volt, you know, various characters are making fun of him or whatever, calling him an explorer, a romantic explorer or something like that. And I think what I got out of the dialogue was – Hal was forced to work on a NASA project that was placing weapon systems in space, and he felt like the idea of just being an exploratory force, the idea of him, you know, exploring that final frontier was being warped and turned into something, you know, militaristic and ugly, and he was disillusioned, and he went off and became a lonely miner. as a result.
And they were using the weapons on people on Earth. Right.
They said that, right. But never showed that.
Yeah, yeah.
Never showed it, and they didn't make it clear if it was on American citizens, on enemies of the state, and apparently it led to a warty political system. Somebody used it for political gain and changed the status of American politics. So that's part of why Hal comes back to set things right. However, they didn't do enough to show what was wrong for us to care about him setting it right.
I agree.
There's a difference between like hooking you into a grander story and then just like leaving you in the fucking desert with no clue what's happening.
Right. I felt like I was in the desert when it came. I understood everything about the Lantern story, the core, the greater mysteries of the Guardians. I got all that and I was in on it. Not only did I not care about the Earth stuff, which is kind of common for a lot of Green Lantern stories for me, but I also didn't understand them, which is a much bigger problem.
Now, perhaps I'm giving them too much credit, but now that I think about it, if a sequel were to explore Hal overthrowing the political system of Earth and setting up one that he is more in favor of, that would be an interesting inversion of the Sinestro story. But perhaps, again, that's giving them credit that they deserve.
That is very interesting. And they do posit an interesting theory early in the book where Hal says to Kilowog, if anybody can grab these rings and use them, what happens if somebody – it's a dick fixed up one of these rings. And Kilowog's like, oh, I never thought of it like that.
Well, then it would be a cock ring, would it not?
The way that we see some of these Green Lanterns wear their rings, I wouldn't be surprised if one of them has a cock ring. Guy Gardner uses a cock ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oof. Pitch idea for next draft.
That notwithstanding.
Write it down. The art. I want to talk about the art a little bit. I haven't mentioned it. I was a little bit surprised that you're so down on the art. I thought it was pretty good for the most part. It's not Ethan Van Sciver.
No,
it's not Ivan Rice.
Nope.
But nobody is on Grant.
So. Yeah, I'm just spoiled. Like, it's just hard. Yeah. Like, I can't. Like, I think that I was outside of Kilowog, I was mostly okay with it. I like Hal's beard, but when the Guardian shows up, there's like 1,000 like word bubbles in this mess of a splash page.
In
what fucking direction am I supposed to be shit? And then I'm starting to get really pissed off.
You just figure it out.
It looks pretty cool, but maybe it's the layout.
You better never finish Alias in that case.
Yeah, you gotta be careful criticizing too many word bubbles around Nick. He gets sensitive.
All the word bubbles, more
just
bubbles.
Just give me a clear direction in which to read them, and I'll read them.
I can see that. Yeah, I thought I think the transitions were an issue in this. No doubt. I think that comes down to layout partially.
They did do interesting things with the layouts, though, by the way. Like, I'm looking at it right now, and a lot of the panels are non-traditional panels. Like, in terms, they're not strict rectangles. They have angles to them. They kind of use that different panel structure to direct your eye in different directions. There are some interesting things done here from a layout perspective, for sure. Like I said, I'm higher on the art than you are, Jenny, but I can certainly understand. It is not Ethan Van Sciver, but I think, to its credit, it doesn't really try to do the classic Green Lantern style of the last, like, 20 years. It's really trying to do something completely different. There's a lot more black, for example. Like,
It's dim. That's what I was about to say.
Yes, it is the dimmest Green Lantern book, for lack of a better term.
There's a lot more shadow. There's a lot more lines in faces and stuff. It's a very different-looking Green Lantern book, but I think that helped it for me because it didn't feel like somebody was doing a bad imitation of the, Van Sciver, Rice style.
Monkey, the big three of the Green Lantern. Jeff Johns artists. It is interesting. And there are times where I think, there are a couple of confusing sequences. I will be honest as well. Maybe you guys can help me out on this. I didn't really completely grasp how they beat the Manhunter.
No, me neither. That made no sense to me.
On Oa, because they say that there's a way – there's somebody that says there's a way – the physicist guy says – there's a way to defeat the Manhunters without blowing up Oa and killing everyone in the bubble or whatever. But they never actually say what it is. And I kept waiting on, like, okay, it happened, they kill the Manhunters or whatever, but then there's never a scene where anybody explains to the audience, okay, this is what we did.
I kind of feel like it was like, try real hard, but not, like, all the way hard to, like, blow shit up. Like, try
semi-hard.
Yeah, just, like a halfy hard to, like, blow these guys up, but not blow the planet up. Right?
Right, right. You don't want to become fully erect when you're going for the big lantern in the middle of the city.
Right, yes.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense to me either. Like, I have no idea how they accomplished that.
Yeah, so that was weird. At the end of it, I have to say, when he came back to Earth, I was kind of let down after the Green Lantern Corps thing. But I think Nick, you and I both feel that way mostly about Green Lantern stuff. We're always more interested when it's in the cosmos, usually, with some exceptions. Ginny, what do you think about that? Were you intrigued by him returning to Earth, or did you want to see him out in space more?
No, definitely more space shit. Like, why go to this bitch on Earth if you're not going to, like, fuck her or punch her in the face?
Or both.
Like, I don't care. Or both. I mean, like, you know, some people are into that. So.
I mean, you don't know. I mean, we don't know how Amy gets down.
I mean, I remember in the Adam Sandler song, At a Medium Pace, which ties into our earliest episode here of HCF, mm-hmm. he mentions ripping the shampoo bottle out of his ass and punching the face. Yeah. So some people like that, you know? Ultimately, overall thoughts on Green Lantern Earth 1. We've kind of been around the bend on this. It sounds like we're all not super high on it. But I think I'm probably the highest of the three on us, because what I would give it credit for is it probably takes the Earth One concept the farthest that I've seen of the ones that I've read. In fact, it definitely does, because it is the most unlike its source material of any of the Earth Ones. So in that regard, I kind of admire it. I kind of admire the fact that they take a lot of risks here with an established character. I don't think Green Lantern purists are going to like it very much, but I think there probably is an audience for it somewhere. I ultimately fall kind of in the camp of great ideas, great concepts are here, but ultimately not executed the way it needed to be executed to really work. I'm not sure, you know, if I was giving a letter grade, maybe a C+ or maybe a B- for me. But yeah, what about I'll go with you first, Nick, and then we'll let Jenny cap us off.
To me, this is as mediocre a thing as we have read for Longbook Hunters in a long time. Like, outside of the terrible version of Hal Jordan, there's not really much in this book that gives me a strong opinion one way or the other. It is, in my view anyway, it's largely forgettable. There are interesting, you know, ideas here set up near the end especially, but for the most part, I could walk away from this book and never give it a second thought, especially if a second volume never comes out. You said C+, B-, I'll go a firm C-, bordering on a C.
Jenny?
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree. With all the wealth of Green Lantern out there, this is not what you want to spend your fucking time reading. Like, there's so much good.
That's a great point that I really hadn't thought about.
Yeah.
And, like, I get it. It's Earth 1 or whatever, but, like, whatever. It's not different enough to be, like, special different. It's weird different. Like, not as good different. So if you want to, like, get into Green Lantern, pick up Rebirth. Don't pick this up, because even if you don't know the continuity, it's still going to give you so much more than this book ever will. And C is probably generous.
Yeah, that is probably the best argument against this book, is that there is a glut of Green Lantern content out there for people that are interested in getting started. There are the 1970s stories from Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams, which Nick and I have reviewed on this show, that are a great entry point for Green Lantern mythos. There are the 80s stories from Steve Englehart and Alan Moore that are a great entry point for the Green Lantern character. There is the He Who Shall Not Be Named run of the late 80s or early 90s that is a good entry point for the character. There is of course, there's the Geoff Johns run. Like you said, Green Lantern Rebirth, frankly, is where I would encourage anyone to go. Or if you're intimidated by not starting with an origin, go to Green Lantern's Secret Origin by Geoff Johns, mm-hmm. which retells Hal Jordan's origin in a modern context and does it, quite frankly, much more compellingly than this does.
Or hey, like right now, the first five issues of the original like Silver Age Green Lantern are up on DC Universe. So if you got a DC Universe subscription, you can go check that out. And there's also a variety of like, you know, snapshots from throughout the Green Lantern publishing history. Whether it be the aforementioned Boone stuff, the Steve Englehart stuff. I don't believe there's any Gerard Jones on DC Universe, and I'm not holding my breath for that.
They actually do have. Last time I checked, if Emerald Dawn, the four issues of Emerald Dawn, but that's it.
I am looking for that right now, and I am
I
not
thought they had
seeing
it. Anyway. Maybe they don't have it, but they did. They have Alan Moore, Tigers, and the other two.
I'll have to look. They keep it.
Tales of the Green Lantern core, but nonetheless, there's plenty of DC Universe. To read, and you know, as far as modern stuff goes, the literal DC Rebirth Green Lantern stories, Hal Jordan mm-hmm. and the Green Lantern and Green Lanterns respectively, have been really good.
Yep.
So check them out if you get a chance. So yeah, I would definitely agree with Jenny. Start with Green Lantern Rebirth and just enjoy the mythos as it is. And I hate to say that because this is a book that took a lot of chances, but. Listen, there's a lot of great Green Lantern stuff out there in over the course of that character's history. And unlike Batman Earth 1, which I think told a Batman story that we had not – Batman story, his origins and his first earliest years as Batman, but told it in a way we had never seen really told before – this doesn't really find that compelling hook for Hal Jordan the way that did for Bruce Wayne. So ultimately kind of an underwhelming long book hunt, I have to say, this week. But certainly not due to our guest. Jenny, thanks so much for offering us your insights into Hal Jordan, Kilowog, cock rings, and everything in between.
That's what I'm here for, the cock ring talk. Thank you for having me, though.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's all shill our shit. Nick and I are at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. We can be found on email, greg@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, and Facebook, Place to Be Nation Comics. Look it up, join the group. We're all around there hanging out, talking about things and stuff. Jenny, where can people find you on social and, shill all of your podcasts?
I can be found at Jenny Cruz 2814 on Twitter and also at Geek and Sassy, which is one of my many podcasts. We just had a new episode with you, Greg Phillips.
Yes. So much fun.
Episode 29, in which we talked about another thing that I did not like very much, Justice League Dark, the animated movie, and Talking Pop, in which Greg Phillips will also be a guest. So.
He sure will, Stevie.
Yep. So be on the lookout for that one. And Freak Out Drive-In, we just had a special Halloween episode a couple weeks ago with me and Cecil Laughlin when we watched Scream. So that was a good time. And I think there might be a special HTF that I'm also involved in, but I don't know what you want me to say about that, so I'll just leave it there.
Oh, yes. No, that's I don't think that's any real secret.
No, it's coming at the end of the month, in a couple weeks.
The end of the month, the week after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We'll give the whole world an early Christmas gift, you might say, or a late mm-hmm. Thanksgiving gift, if people give each other Thanksgiving gifts. I don't know. That might be a thing somewhere. But nonetheless, we will be unveiling the – Nick, you're going to have to say the title.
No. I'm gonna listen to your old college try at this.
Okay, let's see. The 2018,
nope.
the third biennial mm-hmm.
Peter David Memorial
mm-hmm.
Place to Be Nation Fantasy Comic Book Draft presented by mm-hmm. a hypothetical non-reputational
mm-hmm.
DC Comics online unlimited subscription service.
You know, close enough. I'm gonna give you credit for that.
Yes, that was good.
Years later, I finally get credit.
You had to sway through it like a Nick Duke on Saturday on a college football Saturday. But other than that, you did okay.
Like, shoe Judy
Saturday. I didn't fall on my ass and break my back, spinal.
My back is broken. Oh God.
Now Nick, what happened to you out there?
Yeah.
What didn't happen to me out there? Apparently, it was a wild ride, folks. That I have little to no recollection of, but I'm alive and I'm hanging out. I'm here, and it was a day, fair, not too shabby.
You know, Jenny, have you ever heard the expression anywhere else other than in our group chat? Them dogs is on top.
Nope.
Nowhere.
You botched the hell out of that, Greg.
I don't even know what the hell it is. What is it?
I know what
it makes sense. It makes sense.
What now?
Give it to us, Nick.
Oh, them dogs is hell, don't they?
Yeah, that.
An odd statement.
Squidbillies.
Not the oddest statements I've seen from Daddy Nick Duke on a college football Saturday.
No, the oddest statements you've seen are not like just nonsense words. They are the equivalent. Yeah. Now I understand Billy Madison in such a better way.
I award you no points.
Because he insisted on doing a talk and pop, right?
How many times has that happened in the last 3 months? How many times has that happened in the last 3 months? Answer the question.
I waited up like four.
It's not. Yes. You know. It's just.
But you said no bullshit.
Listen. Let me tell you something about Nick Duke, Jenny. When he says no bullshit, the only time he says that
is when there's bullshit.
Intoxicated.
Yes.
And you can't trust anything.
That's true. That's true.
Well, I learned that.
Let me tell you what happened. Here's what happened. I was in the car. I was drinking my car beers on the way to the hotel. And then I got some crystals.
Not driving, of course.
No, not driving. No, Danielle was driving. I was drinking the beers while Danielle was driving. Anyway, got me some crystals, some chili cheese fries, and then I just passed out face down right next to the chili cheese fries and woke up like 4 hours later. Still clothed. So, you know, probably for the best. Probably best for all parties involved.
Yeah.
Best for our listeners. Best for our podcast network.
Best for our relationships with everyone at Place to Be Nation.
Yeah, for sure.
What if you had passed out in the chili cheese fries and that was the way you went? You drowned in
God.
Chili cheese from crystals.
I hope that one day when I die, as glorious a death as passed out drunk in a pool of chili cheese fries. You know,
crystal chili cheese fries.
Hey man, listen, crystal chili cheese fries are good. I don't care what anyone says.
Oh my God,
can't buy that. You can have your opinions on their burgers, and I'll go with you there. But their chili cheese fries are legit, man.
Do you know what's also legit, Nick?
What's that?
Blue Chew.
Oh my God, are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
You combine some Blue Chew with my lack of feeling on Saturday night.
Ooh,
I'm telling
boy.
You, I could have gone for a solid hour, Greg, but that's neither here nor there.
The 60-minute man, that's right. And it's all thanks to our sponsor, Blue Chew.
And our secondary sponsor, a variety of alcohols that I consumed in various quantities.
And of course, our third, our tertiary sponsor, Crystal.
Mm, yes.
Crystal. It does a body horribly.
Yes, it does. There's a reason why people only eat it when they're drunk.
Or high, but yeah.
Well, I mean, whichever. Yeah, altered. Chemically altered in some way. How about that?
Yes, chemically altered. Now,
that's one of my worst memories of working in sports writing. Now we're off topic entirely, but when I used to cover high school football, my friend Marcino and I, we would cover it together there for the Troy Messenger, and then every Friday night when we got off work, we would go order a sack full of crystals and sit there and eat it. And neither one of us enjoyed it. We just sit there and stare at each other as we miserably ate these terrible hamburgers because we weren't drunk, and we never figured out why we kept doing it. We always felt terrible after it was over. We didn't want to do anything. Like, we would all say, "Oh, let's go do something after this." Then we'd eat those crystals and we'd be like, "No, I think I'll just go home and feel miserable." And yet, we kept doing it every week for 2 years.
Don't empty your sack.
Well, you know, it is what it is. Any opportunity to empty your sack, you should take it. That's just my
Absolutely.
Advice.
I mean, that's what I've always said. Mm-hmm. I said that for a long time. But, Jenny, do you have any other projects coming up that people need to be aware of?
Projects? No, I did not.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet.
Well, what were your thoughts on the 2018 draft thing that I said? That's coming up. The Pitches podcast is coming up. I don't think I ever even finished that statement. Pitches podcast. You can listen to all our wonderful pitches.
We're going
to
reveal the grand prize winner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the podcast went really well. The winner was well-deserved. It was a well-deserved win. Not who I would have picked for a win. But, you know, still good,
goodness,
fair.
Goodness.
And, I was happy with my placement in the thing and happy with the participation, you know, that we saw and the number of ballots that we got.
Yes, that's one spoiler that I am willing to let out there, that we got over 20 participants.
25 was the final number.
25 participants.
Almost 26, but... You know, we had some hanging chads that had to disqualify one ballot.
Oh.
Yep. Oh.
That's neither here nor there.
Sure
enough. I say as I sip my Crown and Coke.
Now, Nick, what are your thoughts on the SEC scheduling?
Oh, man. You know, it's terrible. It's awful. And they should not do it anymore because they just keep winning national championships all the time. So
it's stupid, and I hate it.
Yep.
But I will
say
this.
You know what? I wish y'all were doing the wrestling minute right now, or
sure,
JR would show up.
Mm. JR is not prepared. I can tell you that. We can't go behind the process of how this JR is made. But JR is not up. He's in the back gargling his barbecue sauce, getting the pipes warmed up. So,
which really doesn't help much, oddly enough. But,
no,
you know, you would think that gargling barbecue sauce would help you vocally, but no. In fact, it really just makes things worse.
Well, the barbecue sauce is just stage one of the preparation. He also has to gargle the main event mustard and the chipotle ketchup. So it's a 3-stage process, and only in stage one.
And he has to do it while laying on a Casper mattress.
yes, he does. That's a great point.
But we can go ahead and do the wrestling minute. I see why not. In fact,
really?
Yeah, why not? Since there's three of us, why don't I figure out how to open the clock on this computer so that I can put, you know what? Let's not even do that. Let's go to my phone here and do that way. We're going to put, in fact, let's not even do it. Let's look at the grandfather clock here in the corner of the L-shaped studio and put 2 minutes on the clock.
2 minutes.
No, wait, just a second. Three people warrants 2 minutes, and two people warrants 1 minute. Your math is poor, sir.
Well, listen, my 2 minutes may not match another person's 2 minutes. No, I don't know if anyone's ever actually timed the wrestling minute out for themselves before.
Mm.
But you know, it may not always come out to exactly a minute. But needless to say, it's the wrestling 2 minutes. So let's put 2 minutes on the hypothetical clock.
Hypothetical non-rotational clock.
Non-rotational clock. It just sits there on one time.
Yeah, so
Jenny,
time is irrelevant on this clock.
Wrestling, the last week, you have a great, by the way, before we get to that, Jenny's got a great column on Place to Be Nation this week alongside Brian Bayless, where she talks about the week in review in wrestling. She looks at SmackDown and NXT. Brian looks at Raw and...
Skip?
205 Live.
205. Mm-hmm. And they give us their thoughts. On wrestling.
Well, goddamn, what a week to write about wrestling because all the shit happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even watch Raw, but I just saw everything that happened on Raw, like, on social. And goddamn, you can't go anywhere without seeing it. And I was just fucking blown away and just shocked and kind of sad because I wanted to see Becky beat the shit out of Ronda. Am I the only one?
You're not the only one. I will say for that desire, I think what happened Monday might be something of a blessing in disguise because I don't think you would have gotten your wish on Sunday. But now I think there's at least a slight chance you might get your wish down the road, in my opinion.
Maybe in April, perhaps.
Maybe.
I think there's a good chance. I think the one thing that Monday and Tuesday did promisingly is it does look like Becky Lynch is being presented as the star right now. And I think that's a wise move. It shows that the WWE realizes what they have with her. And based on the way things are going, I don't know if they can maintain this momentum all the way through April, but if I were a decision maker at WWE, I would damn sure be pivoting to Ronda and Becky right now, because it feels like that's where the money is. And as Vince is fond of saying, it's all about the money. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm excited about that.
Well, what about what about AJ and Daniel Bryan?
Yes, the big news. Daniel Bryan is now a villain for the first time since 2012, I think, Nick, and has turned on AJ Styles and become the WWE champion, ending a more than 1 year title reign by virtue of a low blow and the mother of all running knees that AJ Styles appeared to have been shot with a cannon as he was hit with. So a lot of stories to unpack here. Daniel Bryan's a heel. Daniel Bryan's the WWE champion. Daniel Bryan will be wrestling Brock Lesnar this Sunday at Survivor Series. And AJ Styles' poor wife. I mean, what must his testicles look like after what he's been through this year between Nakamura and Joe and Bryan?
Maybe get one of those Green Lantern cock rings to help him out.
I like it. A protective green bubble around the junk. To protect against future low blows. Now there's a lot here. I was excited about AJ and Brock wrestling again. They had a great match last year, but Brian and Brock is a long time dream match. But Nick. Brian is a long time favorite of ours, and it is weird to see him as a heel again.
Yeah, my thoughts are too complex to be shared in 2 minutes. Just let's just suffice it to say that I'm genuinely torn on this. I have little doubt that it can work. I'm just not sure it's something I wanted to really see at this point. So,
yep.
We'll cross that bridge in the coming months and see, just play out and see where it goes. Right now, I'm not all for it, but I'm not all against it either.
What are y'all thinking about Survivor Series, Jenny?
God damn, I don't even know what to think anymore. Like, I had it all sort of like mapped out, and now I'm just like, well, what the fuck? Dude, I got nothing.
Nick?
I'm looking forward to the show. It should be interesting, although I think the combination of Daniel Bryan, like, Daniel Bryan from 2 weeks ago wrestling Brock Lesnar, yes, all of that. Daniel Bryan as a heel wrestling Brock Lesnar, I don't even know how that works, man. Like, I don't even know what that match looks like unless it's a 45-second squash, which nobody wants. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Also, as of now, AJ Styles not on the card. We'll have to see if that changes Sunday.
I have to imagine that changes somehow.
Yeah.
Also, NXT TakeOver War Games
on
Saturday night, which I probably won't be able to see live, but it's breaking my heart because NXT pay-per-views are my shit.
They are your shit.
They are my shit.
I should get to the hotel. Yeah, I'll get to the hotel by that point. I can lay there and drunkenly watch it. That'll be good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm looking forward. What match on War Games are you most looking forward to?
Ciampa and Velveteen Dream.
What about you, Nick?
War Games itself.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go War Games itself as well. Although, Sleeper, all four of the matches look awesome.
Yes.
I'm kind of really excited about that 2 out of 3 falls, Shayna versus Kyrie as well.
Because you've got to, like, you can't, every time she's lost this point, you've had somebody, like, roll her up or beat her, you know, while she's had him in a submission. I don't think you can do that 2 out of 3 falls. I'm really interested to see how they work around that.
Very much so. And if they take some cues from the excellent 2 out of 3 falls match we saw earlier this year from New Japan. So, going to be really fun to watch that whole show. Anyway, any other wrestling thoughts you
guys
have?
That's been the wrestling 5 minutes.
Yes, sorry.
Hey,
y'all, let me do that.
Absolutely. We are nothing if not accommodating. And Nick, to address your concern, with Daniel Bryan being a heel now, I felt it was only fair to remind you that I have till 5.
There you are.
With that being said, Jennifer Smith, thank you so much for joining us. As always, you're always welcome here in the Hard Traveling Studios. Thanks for giving us your thoughts on Green Lantern Earth 1 and doing the wrestling, as Nick pointed out, 5 minutes.
Thank you, boys.
Absolutely. We are going to take a break right now. When we come back, we've got a very somber and yet joyful rundown, and we will be sharing a few thoughts about the passing of Stan Lee. And we are also going to have reading and watching. Spoiler alert, it's main watching.
Mm-hmm.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
American Dream. He's just a common man.
We are back live and in public, ladies and gentlemen. Right here. The Hard Traveling Studios, if you will. And Nick, how was your commercial break?
Oh, it was great.
Mine too. One of the fastest 2 minutes in entertainment, I'd have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know about the fastest 2 minutes, nobody circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bills.
Well, and if you're worried about your fastest 2 minutes, check out BlueChew.com.
Absolutely. That fastest 2 minutes will turn into the most enjoyable 2 hours of your life.
For you, and at least. Hers.
Absolutely. Well, we're using a bit of levity because there's really no way to transition into this on our show. We try to keep things light. But the big news in the comic book world, we're going to go ahead and kick off our segment. Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown.
With the biggest news in the comic book world by far of the year, probably.
Arguably one of the biggest stories ever, like at least in our lifetimes.
In our lifetime, certainly. It is the passing at age, I believe, 95 of Marvel Comics founder, Marvel Comics public face, the co-creator of virtually all the heavy hitter Marvel characters that you know and love, the man who has arguably been the face of the comic book industry for over half a century. Mm-hmm. Stan Lee passed away at the age of 95 this week. Obviously, everyone knows that by this point. You're not getting that news broken by the Hard Traveling Fanboys. But we did find it appropriate to dedicate a portion of our show just to chatting about Stan and the legacy and the impact that he made not only on the comic book industry, on our lives, on our generation, our parents' generation, even our grandparents at this point's generation. It's incredible to see the love and support coming out for Stan after his death. Nick, I know that you know, one of your favorite characters is Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. You're Thor. I mean, all so many great Stan creations, but you also have a special – probably an increased knowledge, love, and respect of Stan Lee through doing the Marvel Age podcast.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm any kind of an expert or thing like that, but it has been – I talked about this a little bit. I just did an episode of Marvel Age Masterclass with the esteemed Ben Morris, who was lucky enough to to actually have met Stan on multiple occasions. So if you want to hear some of his recollections of the man, that episode is out now, and I talked about it a little bit on there as well. So I'll try to be as eloquent as I was there, which wasn't very. So the point I kind of made on that podcast was, Greg, you and I, for our entire lives, we've never really known Stan Lee as a comics creator. And what I mean by that is, in our lifetimes, he's always been that comics figurehead. He's been an ambassador for the industry. He has been the kindly old grandfather of comics. And yeah, we all knew all along that, like, he created all these characters, but I don't think any of us, or most people of our age, unless you've gone back and read a lot of that stuff, really have an appreciation for just how good it was and how inventive it was and how, I mean, only 7 years into the Marvel Age project, one thing I've wondered aloud is, like, I am watching characters grow up and age and progress in front of my eyes. And in modern day comics, characters don't do that. Characters are perpetually locked into a cycle that they can never escape. They aren't allowed to really change. And Stan Lee back then, you know, unburdened by expectations that somebody be writing these characters 20 years later, was just doing everything he could to make these characters feel relatable, to make them feel like real people. And that, more so than anything, I would argue, is what the creation of the Marvel Universe was built upon. And it carries forward, you know, through the decades in print, in television, in podcasts, even with the Wolverine podcast that's going on now, and of course in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which are arguably one of the most influential film franchises to ever exist. The man truly launched millions of people's imaginations, billions of people's imaginations, even over the last 50 years. So it's a life well lived. 95 years is a long time, and he accomplished so much. And there's a small bit, or not a small bit, one underpublicized thing of Stan Lee that I think, especially you and I and other people who are no longer in our teens and 20s, can take a little bit of solace in.
Yep.
The man, Stan Lee, didn't really become Stan Lee until age 39. He created the Fantastic Four at age 39. Everything he did in life that we will remember him for, from a professional standpoint, came in what would technically be his middle-aged or elder years. Life is not over. Life does not end at 30. And there's a little bit of a nugget of a lesson to be taken out of that. So,
absolutely.
Rest in peace to the man. I don't really know what else to say. I know I am grateful for his work, and I don't really know how else to put that.
Well said, Nick. Very well said. And the point that you made about the work that he did after age 9. Think about the fact that Stan Lee, our whole lives, was an elder, as you put it. He was our grandparents' age, and yet had more youthful energy than I think either of us have at I'm 34 and you're 30, right? So it's amazing. This man was 39 and into his 40s, and he's creating the most enduring teenage character in the history of comics in Spider-Man. He is creating, alongside great artistic giants, not to belittle the work of Kirby and Ditko and Heck and all these other people that were working right alongside him, but they're creating these characters that inspired children to be creative, but also that were entertaining high school and college students and even grown adults. Stan, I think more than anyone, through his words, is responsible, by and large, for progressing comics, superhero comics, beyond what they were before, and maturing them, so to speak, to a level where you're dealing with questions of philosophy, you're dealing with battling prejudice and injustice, and doing it in a way that is going to appeal to people at any age, and kind of setting comics on the path that led us to the modern era, where we're at now. And when you look back at the characters that he's created, it's obvious. When you look back at the stories that he wrote, it's obvious. Just listen to Marvel Age Masterclass here at Place to Be Nation Pop, and you'll hear how these stories progress over the years and some of the great work that is done to lay the foundations of our modern mythology. It's not just comic books. He, with superheroes, he created modern American mythology. It took the place of the Paul Bunyans and the John Henry 1800s and really launched in the 20th century what now defines our pop culture, by and large. And that's coming from a man in his 40s. But I don't just want to define him by the ideas. He did the work. He was writing so many books, Nick, in a given month. I can't even wrap my mind around it. Like, this guy was writing so many different things at the same time.
And editing.
Editing and publishing at one point. And basically, and essentially doing the job of three or four men at the same time over a period of about 10 years of creative spark.
Yeah.
And it's
he was Timely Comics. And then eventually, for a long period of time, he was Marvel Comics. Yes, you had artists, but in terms of, like, he was writing, editing, serving as publisher. Like, he was
being the public face.
Right.
He was marketing the comics. He was helping with the TV productions. It was yeoman's work. I don't know what a yeoman is, but he was doing that work. And it's incredibly inspiring because he was at an age when people are starting to slow down, when people are, you know, hell, I'm at 34 and I feel myself lacking the energy that I had even a few years ago. And he never lacked that energy. He never lacked positivity, which is the other thing that I think we can take from Stan Lee and his life well lived. Stan Lee was, for better or worse, always going to be about positivity. He was going to talk about the good things in the comic book industry. He was going to talk about the good things in the world. And he taught us all through his characters that if you're different, if you're depressed, if you're down, if you feel like you may be out and you're not, don't ever give up, because his characters and his writing always inspired us to strive to be greater, to pull ourselves up and be the best people we can be and treat each other with kindness and respect. And I think that, even more than the characters, even more than the stories, that is the greatest legacy that Stan Lee leaves behind, a legacy of kindness and a legacy of respect. So I will miss Stan. We all will miss Stan. But, you know, we just lost Eve Ditko over the summer. There's something poetic about the closeness of those two passing. And, you know, I really hope that the day will come again when we find a creative era like that, where we have that level of originality and progression, as you pointed out, in the comics, in mainstream superhero comics. But it's highly unlikely, because I don't know that we're ever going to have three like Dan, Jack, and Steve again. So anyway, that's our thoughts on the passing of Stan Lee, and at least some of our thoughts on it. We invite you to send us your recollections of Stan Lee. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. We will mention your thoughts on the show, because we are actually dedicating next week's episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys to Stan Lee. We called a bit of an audible here, and we are going to present a countdown next week of our top five Stan Lee creations. We want to hear your top five Stan Lee creations. Tweet them to us. You can email them to us. You can post them, send them via Facebook message, whatever you do. We want to celebrate Stan Lee next week here on the show. And Nick, I think this is the best way we can do it with our you know, mild and limited ability to do anything. We're going to do our best to kind of talk about the Stan Lee creations that meant the most to us.
Absolutely. I can't wait.
And with that being said, we're going to transition to the next story here on our shorter than usual edition of the Rundown. And let's go to a little segment, a little section, rather, of the studio. You may remember as the Worlds of DCEU Corner.
I don't fucking know.
The latest news in the DC Worlds of DCEU is that Ella J. Basco, a relative newcomer, is in negotiations to land the last major role in the Birds of Prey film of Cassandra Cain. Now, many people who are comic book officials or longtime DC Comics fans will know that Cassandra Cain was the second long-term Batgirl after Barbara Gordon, at least modern Batgirl after Barbara Gordon, and was the Batgirl of the late 90s and early 2000s. She was a mute for quite a while, didn't talk much or at all. And has had a role recently as the character of Orphan, as they reintroduce her with that codename. Your thoughts on this casting news?
I have no idea who this person is, but I just looked up, an image of her. She looks very young. She looks to be of Asian descent, so a little bit more diversity being added to the cast and into the DC worlds of DC whatever franchise thing they're calling it at this point. So those are both good things. Big fan of how Cassandra Cain has been handled in recent years in particular. So hoping she has a major role to play in this Birds of Prey film. We'll see how this goes. They are choosing to fill out the cast with mostly unknowns outside of Ewan McGregor and Margot Robbie. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and the backstory of Cassandra Cain is actually really cool. I remember the storyline where they introduced her with her father, David Cain, was a major Batman villain at the time. So she's the daughter of an assassin, David Cain, and another assassin, Lady Shiva, one of the preeminent hand-to-hand combatants in the DC universe, and is deprived of speech and contact during her childhood conditioning. So it leads to her kind of status as a mute for many years. But really good character. Really interested to see what they can do with her on the screen. Now I got some. Well, Nick, there's no other way to describe this news except
annoying.
A word. Yeah, annoying is a good. Well, I guess there are other ways. Annoying is a good way.
Doo-doo shit.
That's exactly what I was going to say. A doo-doo shit announcement from the W.
We had to know this was coming, though.
The latest brand new doo-doo shit CW show called Roswell, New Mexico. I don't know that it's going to be doo-doo shit, Nick, but I read the description. It sounds a little bit like doo-doo shit. Anyway, it will the 2019 mid-season schedule has been released, and the new series Roswell, New Mexico, which is the name of a city and a state, will premiere Tuesday, January 15th. A 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock Eastern block, which will move Black Lightning to Mondays after Arrow, starting on January 21st. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, wait a minute, Legends of Tomorrow come on after Arrow right now in that spot? And you'd be right. Well, here's what they're doing with Legends of Tomorrow. Legends of Tomorrow will return to Mondays in April.
So it leaves in December? And doesn't come back until April?
Doesn't come back until April. It's taking a three-month hiatus to then come back with the second half of the season. Mm. There's a couple of aspects to this. The number one aspect is that Legends of Tomorrow is one of the best comic book shows on TV.
That not enough people watch.
For a while. Not enough people watch it, clearly. And it's being dicked around in scheduling, again, as it has been since season two. And they are sacrificing it essentially for the sake of a brand new doo-doo shit show that can join other doo-doo shit shows such as Dynasty.
Yep. And what's the other, what are some other ones?
Let's see.
Jane the Virgin.
Legacies.
Mm-hmm. Riverdale.
Legacies. All-American – well, All-American might be good. I don't know. It looks somewhat compelling.
The point is, outside of the CW shows – or outside of the DC shows, excuse me, CW shows are most do shit.
That's right. And I'm pleading with you. If you're a listener of this show, I plead with you to watch Legends of Tomorrow, to record it at the very least, so that we can help preserve it for the future. Because, Nick, I'm getting more and more – worried about the future of one of my favorite shows.
And they dick around the schedule and then wonder why people – I mean, that doesn't help, you know?
It doesn't help at all. You can't – I don't think they realize people have routines. Even we have a routine with how we watch the shows, Nick, with our show. But people have routines that they get in, and those routines are important. And if you disrupt that routine, it decreases the ability of the people to watch the show. When The Simpsons prominently moved nights back in the 90s, it was one of the most watched shows on TV, so it was able to sustain its audience. But I would say 8 times out of 10, when you do that to a show, you diminish the audience. You do it even more when you do it repeatedly and you change time slots along. People just can't keep up. There's too much competition. And it's just it's not good. I don't like it at all, Nick, and I'm worried about the future of the show.
I am as well. But now that DC Universe exists, I would have to think if something did happen to Legends, it would be a prime candidate for being saved by that streaming service. So we'll see.
Well, with all that being said, I think that brings an end to the rundown.
It does.
Now, before we get on to Reed Muchin, Nick, listen, when you look at the state of college football right now, what are you seeing there on the plains?
Oh, a dumpster fire, and it's one of the most beautiful blazes I've ever seen in my life. It's glorious, man. But I know that it you know, at the very least, that even if they suck at football, Greg, they have a lot of class and they have high integrity, and they wouldn't do anything sorry during a football game.
No, they wouldn't. They've got class, not ass.
That's right. That's right.
Let's move on to our weekly look at what we've been reading and watching in the comic book world. It's a segment, Nick, that we like to call Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What have you been reading and watching?
Inventive as it is.
And so, let's get it. Should we get cracking with the CW stuff, or should we get into the stuff that maybe we've been watching outside of that world?
However you want to do it.
Let's go ahead and start with the CW stuff.
Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, I didn't watch Supergirl.
I just finished it right before we went on air.
There you go.
Let's start with – actually, I'll catch up because I watched 2 episodes of Supergirl. I watched last week's Supergirl, which I hadn't watched before our show a week ago, and I didn't really like it.
Yeah, I thought this was probably the weakest episode of Supergirl this season, in my opinion.
Yeah, anyway. I agree. It did nothing for me. It was – I'm still not with the exception of the Agent of Liberty origin episode, which I thought was great, none of the episodes this season have really hooked me. And I've come down to it that I'm just not that invested in the We Hate Aliens plot, because it feels like it's been done before, and B, it feels like it is getting increasingly heavy-handed at times, and C, the only compelling member of the villains to me has been the Agent of Liberty. I came down finally. I know they were disposed of in this episode. I came down on not really liking this version of Mercy and Otis. Nick, I don't know about you.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like him, and I do like Agent of Liberty. He's an interesting character. Don't really like the DEO defectors. I'm not really interested in their subplot. I haven't been interested in any of the DEO drama. I miss Mon-El on the show. You know, Jean's stuff's been fine, as it always is. But I don't know. It's just the show hasn't hooked me to this point. I did watch the most recent episode. I know you have. I'll avoid spoilers on that. But it was better. It was better than last week, I thought. But not a great episode, but just a pretty good episode that had moments here and there. But, again, nothing that really grabbed me the way I wanted to, but still a step up from last week. So we can talk about that maybe next week once you've watched it.
Yeah, absolutely we will, for sure.
So let's get cracking on last week's helping of CW shows, Supergirl, again, Nick hasn't watched yet. The Monday we had Arrow, and this was an episode that introduced us, I believe it was called Level 2, and it introduced us to a new character, a psychologist that works at the at the prison where Oliver's been sent to this level 2, which is only for the most dangerous and violent criminals. He is undergoing a psychological evaluation at the hands of this new psychologist character whose name escapes me, and I don't have the Wikipedia page pulled up. But meanwhile, back in Star City, Felicity is trying to extract information from the Silencer, who she and Renee captured in the last episode. And she is going to increasingly desperate measures to get this information about where Ricardo Diaz is from the Silencer, even enlisting the help of Laurel Lance, aka Black Siren. And then further meanwhile, we are taken back into the world of Flash Forwards as we meet back up with William and Roy as they return to a futuristic Star City that is in shambles. And furthermore, we have Dinah and Renee trying to – they're kind of at odds, actually, about the new Green Arrow, as the new Green Arrow takes another more active role in Star City, working with Renee and forging an uneasy alliance with Dinah, who is rapidly filling the role formerly played by Quentin Lance on the show. Lot to unpack here, Nick. I know that was a mouthful, and it sounds like it could be an overstuffed episode, but this was freaking awesome.
Yeah. Arrow continues just not the park. I don't want to, you know, dive too much into the specifics of it all for people who somehow are behind or whatever, but this was right up my alley. Lots of, lots of emotional torture essentially going on. I think they continue to – they really – I mean, I'm not saying that it's bad necessarily, but pretty much any time they try to give the members of New Team Arrow stuff to do, it's not as interesting as Oliver and Felicity's angles. But luckily, they've learned the right proportion, because right now I think we're humming at about 80% Oliver and Felicity and about 20% everybody else, which is a fine mix. And hopefully as we go along, the other aspects of the show will at least – well, I mean, nothing is going to be as interesting to me as Oliver in prison, but at least maybe they can close the gap a little bit and have the show working on all cylinders.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed Renee this season. He's a character that in the past, Wild Dog, I was very critical of. As you know, I went up and down on him in various points. Hated him early on, liked him later, hated him again last season. They've really done a great job of rounding him out. The actor feels like he has really just grown into the role. I love his relationship with his daughter. I love the fact that he is a caged, complex character. I've enjoyed all of the Team Arrow people this year except for Curtis, who I don't even think was in this episode. Oliver in prison, where it's at. Like that, the scenes of emotional torture, I don't want to get into specifics as well, but he has to relive painful moments from his past. And I don't know about you, Nick, but I thought the flashback sequences with him on the boat and then the scene with him and William in particular was extremely powerful.
Yes, I would agree with that for sure.
Some of Stephen Amell's finest work. The flash forward was great too, I thought, this week. I don't know what to make of any of this, where it's going, but I'm along for the ride, and I'm curious to see what has led Star City down this path. Any theories on that, Nick?
None whatsoever. I am completely thrown for a loop by Flash Forwards, and I don't know how much of an answer we're going to get, because the showrunners have said the Flash Forwards will continue until the show itself ends. So if we're going to get another season of Arrow, I wonder how much they're really going to be able to reveal in the Flash Forwards this season.
Good point. And we don't know if this is a fixed flash forward or if this is still something that could be avoided. We don't know. Like, the whole thing's up for grabs, basically. And finally, Nick, I have to ask you, any theories about the new Green Arrow?
No theories.
Caller. Okay, so then after Arrow, we had Legends of Tomorrow, which took us to the late 70s era of British punk bands as the Legends are trying to find a magical anomaly that is in a British punk band circa 1977. And of all people, it is the most unlikely member of the team, Ray Palmer, straight-laced Ray Palmer, sent to infiltrate this band of misfits. And wouldn't you know it, Sentimental Ray has a soft spot for the lead singer of the band that ends up being the magical entity that they're after. The team wants to send her. Ray wants to save her. It creates conflict, and that's to say nothing of the subplots involving John Constantine's family, which kind of added a little bit of seriousness to the episode, or the bits involving Nate and Gary and their excursion at the what is the name of the Time Bureau, their work with the Time Bureau, and all that's another, suffice to say, another incredibly fun episode of Legends.
Yeah, Legends continues to be do things that only Legends can do. I will say I probably enjoyed this the least of any of the three episodes this year so far, just because I don't think I found that new female character that is going to play a role going forward as interesting as it feels like the writers did. Her attitude seems very kind of like what Zari was this year, and mm-hmm. I don't know that we need to rehash that over again.
Right, I would agree with that. And it's hard to match it when you've had a fairy godmother and a unicorn.
Right.
A killer unicorn at that. But yeah, I loved pretty much all the character stuff in this episode with the Legend elves and Constantine, who's a perfect fit for the show. But my favorite part was definitely Ray, because like Ray Palmer is just such a great like straight arrow character. Maybe I can relate to that, Nick, I don't know, but mm-hmm. he's such a goober pretty much in every situation that he's stuck in. And it was pretty fun seeing him try to explore his quote-unquote wild side. So fun stuff all around, even if I agree that it's not quite as good as the previous two episodes.
Right.
Tuesday night brought us...
Nothing.
Nothing, yeah. The Tuesday. You're right. The shows were off on Tuesday. You're right. Yep, good point. Right again, Nick. Right again. So that's it for the CW shows. We just had three,
mm-hmm.
and you haven't watched one of them.
That's right.
You did. Yeah, you know, you didn't watch one. So, rank them, Nick.
Arrow and then Legends.
Yes. I would go Arrow, Legends, and Supergirl. Although that's no knock on Supergirl. I thought it was fine for what it was, but clearly Legends was better, and clearly Arrow was head and shoulders about everything this week. I was going to say, Nick, I don't think it would have mattered if we had Flash or Black Lightning this week.
Yeah,
Arrow was not going to be topped. Right. So, good shit all around. Well, been watching anything else, Nick?
No, not to my knowledge.
Not that you remember?
No.
I have watched two things, in fact, in addition to our CW shows this past week. I watched the latest episode of Titans on the DC Universe app alongside our good friends and fellow podcast hosts, Russell Sellers of Sellers Points Podcast and the Marvel Age Masterclass. And
Marvel Age Masterclass is a different thing altogether.
Whatever. They're all in the same family.
They're all in the same family, but you're sitting here saying that you can hear Russell on the Marvel Age Masterclass when...
Which you can
on occasion, but he's not on every episode the way he is Marvel Age. Get his credentials correct, for God's sake. Do some research. Prepare.
DC Post-Crisis Management, which I have been a part of, and I believe soon you'll be able to hear our beloved new addition to the family here, Nick, Mitch Okun will be on there, and that can be available soon, Russell Sellers, and of course the host of Sunday Groove podcast, David Sunday, who's got a new podcast with Andy Helene on it, talking about concert experiences. We were watching Titans together, and... damn it, another good episode of this show. It just feels like it's getting better and better to me. I continue to enjoy the journey of Raven, but for the first time, I enjoyed Starfire and Beast Boy as well, particularly Beast Boy. I feel like his personality is pretty fully formed. Starfire, I think there's still work to be done there to get her where she needs to be, but... Dick Grayson continues to be good and tortured, as I like my Dick Grayson to a degree. And we also continue to see growth in Raven and Beast Boy coming to know each other. We see more with the nuclear family, Nick, that I know you were a fan of when you saw them. Mm-hmm. A truly bizarre concept that is creepy in the best ways. We get to see that explored. We see more about the mysterious doctor who is the backer of the nuclear family and apparently the creator of the nuclear family. And we see Dick Grayson try to put an end to things on his own, and it doesn't necessarily turn out the way he would have liked. And most intriguingly of all, we get to see the first appearance of Jason Todd.
Interesting.
At the very end of this episode, Dick Grayson gets himself in over his head, and he looks like he's about to be taken out by assassins, only rescued by Jason Todd, by a new person wearing the Robin costume, and revealing that even though Dick is mad at him, Bruce is still monitoring him and looking out for him. We do get a little bit more about Dick's backstory, a bit of training with everybody using their powers. The effects on Beast Boy still not exactly the tiger from Walking Dead love, but getting a little bit better. And then Raven, of course, always looks cool with her powers. And Starfire's powers look cool. So everything's working out good so far. The show is getting better and better. Next episode I'm really excited for because it's just titled Jason Todd. So that should be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'll probably catch up at some point. I think I've only seen like two episodes. Yeah, it was Hawk and Dove episode two.
Yes.
And that's all I've seen, yeah.
Yep. And then watch the latest episode of The Walking Dead, the first post-Rick episode of The Walking Dead. And it started a little cheesily. I was very unsure. It had an overly dramatic monologue from Michonne set to a montage of characters as we're now 6 years in the future. And there's what appeared to be a badly – maybe it was real. I shouldn't say it's CGI'd. It was just so bright in comparison with the rest of the background that looked like the birds may have been fake, but it was kind of corny. That being said, that was only the first 2 or 3 minutes of the episode. Walking Dead came out of the gates firing with a tremendous episode, laying a truly new and fresh feeling gravel floor for the show, a new status quo. Judith Grimes is one hell of a compelling character with a child actress that is really doing a great job of playing a character one of the few, we've talked about this, Walking Dead has a long list of annoying child characters. She's not. Judith is absolutely not. She is one of the best kid characters they've had on the show, certainly the best since the era of Walking Dead, and very compelling character. The advancement and kind of almost insanity of Michonne in this episode, it was also really compelling to see the progression of Carol, the progression of Henry, the progression of Ezekiel, Eugene becoming much more self-sufficient than he's ever been before by necessity. the only development I didn't like was Gabriel is now in a relationship with Rosita, apparently. But it led to a phenomenal exchange between Rosita and Eugene as they're riding on a mission in which Eugene basically grills her about why she would be with someone like Gabriel, who believes in fairy tales and has one eye, when she could be with someone else who believes in hard fact science.
Yes.
And she says, "Do you have anyone in specific in mind?" And he goes, "No, I was just generally speaking." And then he's about to confess his undying love for her, and she literally tells him to shut up, don't make it weird, and helps him escape from a horde of walkers. Really good stuff.
I'm glad to hear that you are continuing to enjoy it.
I am. It was a terrific episode. To quote Todd Weber, the manager, "Walk it back, baby."
Good to hear.
So that's that. That's all I've been watching. I got nothing else. You been playing anything, Nick?
No, nope, no plan.
Been listening to anything?
No, not comic book related anyway.
Mm, been listening to any Paul Feinbaum?
I've been on there for a few minutes, and then that's all I could take, really. So, you know, just a few minutes, just taste, and then that's plenty enough for me.
Remember the words of a great man, Nick. Ain't no harm in having a little nip, but don't you fall down and bust your lip.
My lip is intact. My back is not. It's just...
Now, you're telling me that back is broken?
I don't know that it's broken. It's that...
What part of your back? Vertebrae?
I would say spinal, personally.
That's good. Oh, Ray Charles. The great Ray Charles!
Oh. He should do a guest spot on Dick in the Booty with that affectation.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, with that being said, I guess that's about the end of our show, Nick.
It is, and yet it's not, because as we have done every week or sometime now, we are going to close the show with a with a little musical exit from the great Jim Ross. And you know, this week we talked about we talked a little bit about the passing of Stan Lee, and such an impact on our childhoods, no doubt about that. And here's Jim Ross to sing you a little song about a little toy he used to have that had quite the impact on his childhood. Good old JR, take it away.
Well, thank you once again, Nick. I know it's been somewhat of a somber mood here today, but I just want to say the Sooners won again. Once again, they only have one loss this year, 3 points. So who's counting? It's been a good day. I heard you mention earlier that I was gargling barbecue sauce. That's not true, because usually if you gargle, it means you spit it out. I swallowed every damn bit of it, and it was delicious, quite frankly. Now, allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is JR, and I'm here to deliver a little song, as Nick said, a childhood that my father once gave to me. When I was a little bitty boy, my grandmother bought me a cute little toy. Silver bells on a string. She told me it was my ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling. I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And then Mama took me to grammar school, but I stopped off in the vestibule. Every time that bell would ring for a time limit draw, catch me playing with my ding-a-ling-a-ling. Ah! My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. Ah! My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want your ass to play with my ding-a-ling. That's beautiful. You know what I heard? I heard two girls over here singing in harmony. That's all right, honey. That's fair. That's decent. Not too shabby. This is a free country. You can live like you want to live, baby. And Dream used to say, do what you want to do, baby. Are you an assassin or are you an errand boy? Yeah, ain't nobody going to knock it, dog. Mm-mm. Freedom. Yes, sir. Guy right over here, he's singing mine. Some Richard over here on the internet saying, oh, mine, mine to you. And that's all right, brother. You got it right. There ain't nobody going to tell you or bother you about any of this shit. Back to the song here. Once I was climbing the garden wall, I slipped and had a terrible fall. I fell so hard that I heard bells ring, but I held on to my ding-a-ling-a-ling. That's right, my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, I want you to play my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling-a-ling. You know, that's future Parliament Funkadelic out there singing. Oh, yeah!
You know, here we go. Here's one of my favorite lyrics. My daddy used to sing this to me all the time. Once I was swimming across Turtle Creek, man, them snappers all around my feet. Sure was hard swimming across that thing with both hands holding my ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, my ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling. I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling. I want your ass to play with my ding-a-ling, you son of a bitch. That is so beautiful. I think it's a beautiful song. Really, I do. And guess what? Of course, because you are young and you're defiant, not everybody's singing along right now. There's a few people on the internet, not many, but some, that are not singing along. So we're going to dedicate this verse to the Richards and the speculators on the internet and the dirt sheets who will not sing. Yes, sir. Well, this here song, it ain't so sad, the cutest little song you ever had. Those of you who will not sing, you must be playing with your own ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. My ding-a-ling, my ding-a-ling, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. Oh yeah, your ding-a-ling, your own ding-a-ling, we saw you playing with your ding-a-ling. Oh, my ding-a-ling, everybody sing, I want you to play with my ding-a-ling. Slow down, everybody, I want to play, everybody now, everybody listen home, with my, now stay with me, follow me, if you have any issues, just take it up, so tweet me at JRsBBQ, ding-a-ling.
Is over. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to put this filth behind us.